Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The earth moves, the world watches, the people of Chile wait. This woman near the epicenter is arguing that what police call looters are just taking necessities. An estimated 2 million displaced people in Chile await assistance from the Chilean government from a combination earthquake tsunami, far more powerful but less deadly than the catastrophe in Haiti. Perils on the Pacific Rim. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, March 1st. Lynn Scher is with me for one more day while Celeste is on the road. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning, John. Good to be with you.
Let's just note for a moment how the devastation of an earthquake has almost nothing to do with the amount of energy released comparing Haiti to what's going on in Chile.
I beg your pardon?
You can release a lot of energy, but it's the way the buildings are constructed,
right.
The way people
right.
are settled, the state of the
so
soil.
So the fact that it was
right.
such a strong earthquake,
exactly.
It was two totally different situations.
Totally different situations.
Astounding difference between an industrial country and one that's not yet developed.
One of the differences, certainly.
Let's get right to that and other top stories that we're following this morning, John. The government in Chile is trying to control the outburst of lawlessness following Saturday's earthquake, the seventh strongest ever on record, as you said, 500 times more powerful than the one in Haiti. That's the sound of police in Concepcion using water cannons to disperse crowds. Chilean President Michelle Bachelet has ordered a curfew and thousands of troops to the city to keep order. More than 100 aftershocks have also rattled the region. Chilean Senator Evelyn Matei tells our partner, the BBC, strong building codes prevented total devastation.
It's a miracle that only 700 people have died. We really build very strictly with rules concerning that buildings can withstand earthquakes.
Initial estimates put the damage in the range of $30 billion.
We go live now to Santiago, Chile, where we're joined by Daniel Vergara in Cheyenne, 70 miles east of Concepcion. Good morning, Daniel. What was it like going back to close to the epicenter into the town where you're from?
Good morning, John. Good morning, Lane. It was very, very impressive. I've taken that road. It's roughly a four-hour drive, 1,000 times in my life, but this is the first time that I've seen so much devastation, so many detours. All the pavement, all the highways were cracked, many buildings down, a lot of detours. But it was doable, and I had to come to see my family. So,
all right, well, we want to talk to you about what you found when you did finally find your family and also the other human costs close to the epicenter. We'll have more of that discussion in just a moment.
Thanks, John. And in other news, here at home, the White House is calling for a simple up or down vote on the health care bill. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says lawmakers should pass the Senate bill, circumventing a Republican filibuster by a process called reconciliation. Republicans are crying foul, arguing they should go back to square one. But President Obama's top health care official, Nancy Ann DeParle, tells NBC News,
what is that really code for? Is that just code for let's not do anything? And I don't think that's what the American people want.
DeParle says the president may endorse reconciliation in the next few days.
2,000 federal transportation workers won't have a job to go to today. The Transportation Department says they were furloughed because Republican Senator Jim Bunning blocked passage of a bill that would have extended federal highway and transit programs. On the final day of the Winter Olympics, some are calling it one of the greatest games in Olympic history, the U.S. men's hockey team fell behind 2-0 against Canada, tied it up in the final seconds, send it to overtime, but with a flick of the wrist, it was over. Canada's national honor is saved. Very festive atmosphere at last night's closing ceremonies. Let's look at the markets very quickly. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up. The Dow will get underway this first day of March at 10,325. The S&P opens at 1,104, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,238. What is the power of numbers? We're on the verge of 1,000 lost in Operation Enduring Freedom. Not enough. 8.8 on the Richter scale seems a lot less deadly than 7.0 right now. When a number has really meant something to you, give us a call. Tell us the story, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. It was a massive release of energy, the earthquake on Saturday morning in Chile. 8.8 on the Richter scale, 500 times more powerful than the quake that killed 230,000 Haitians last month. You're listening to police using water cannon to disrupt people trying to find necessities in the rubble. Millions of displaced Chileans are waiting for assistance from the government. Here are some more voices from near the epicenter.
We ran up to the hill and we were there all night. We saw how the waves took everything and the noise was immense.
That's a woman speaking from the coastal region of Chile, which, and I'm here with Lynn Scherer here at the Takeaway Studios in New York. You know, they had a tsunami and an earthquake in Chile over the weekend.
It's so unimaginable to those of us living in a city surrounded by tall buildings. We don't know what this is like.
Well, certainly this man who was near the coast felt the earthquake and then waited for the waves.
It caught us off guard. We were sleeping. It didn't give us a chance to grab any of our things, not even a blanket. All we did was grab our kids and run up the hill.
Communications near the epicenter, Concepcion, which is believed to be the most severely damaged city, are still down. There have been multiple reports of shortages of gas and water as well. And as I said, 2 million people estimated to be displaced by this earthquake, which began on Saturday. BBC Chile correspondent Gideon Long joins us from Santiago. Good morning, Gideon.
Good morning, John.
So where do things stand this morning? We understand aftershocks have been pretty much continuous since Saturday.
There have been several aftershocks overnight of a magnitude of around 5. So those shocks are still continuing, obviously causing a lot of concern for those people down in the south who've been devastated by this quake.
And tell us about the damage of earthquake versus the tsunami. I mean, it was relatively minor. I mean, it was trivial, actually, out in the Pacific, where they were waiting for tsunami warnings, et cetera, in Hawaii and Indonesia and Australia. But close to the Chilean coast, it was a different story.
Absolutely. Some of the places have been very badly hit by the tsunami. Talcahuano, for example, which is one of Chile's major ports. It's the main port of the city of Concepcion. Very, very badly hit. Huge waves came in there. It picked up fishing vessels and hurled them into the city's streets and squares. And smaller places as well. There have been villages up and down the coast, Dichato, Yoyue, Iloco, that have been basically destroyed completely by the waves that came in the wake of the tsunami. In the wake of the quake.
We have you and the BBC to thank for those two voices from Ilyoko who are talking about how they were caught off guard by both the earthquake and the tsunami. Gideon Long, stay with us. So I want to bring in Daniel Vergada, who's an industrial engineer who we were speaking at the top of the hour, who's from Chillen, which is 70 miles east of Concepcion, which is believed to be the closest large city to the epicenter. Daniel Vergada, why do you think there is so much of an ethic among Chileans to build buildings to withstand earthquakes? The death toll is tragic, but nothing like what we've seen in other earthquakes, particularly Haiti, just a few weeks ago.
Well, good morning, everyone. I would say that it's mainly two reasons. This country, everyone knows, and every Chilean knows it since the moment they're born, that we live in a very, very, very seismic region. We all know that the faults, the Nazca plates, it's a known story for everyone, so everyone gets basic teaching, basic learnings from running away from earthquakes, staying under tables, under door frames, and that helped to limit the loss of lives. And the buildings, I mean, this same city, Chillen, my hometown, has been struck twice by very big earthquakes with epicenters very close to this city. And I'm actually standing now in what we call New Chillen, because the old Chillen was completely destroyed. This city was built from scratch like 50 years ago, which helped the city sustain the earthquake that we had now. I mean, mostly every major building is standing right now. And the second reason I would say is that we've had a very good laws and building codes. I mean, we've been very responsible about that. So I guess everyone followed them, and thankfully we have no major tragedies in the big cities.
Well, Daniel, you make an extraordinary point. There are many, many towns in Chile that have an old and a new based on earthquakes down through history. First of all, tell me, though, did you find your family safe when you finally got to Chillen? You made the arduous journey from Santiago to Chillen.
Yeah, well, fortunately, around 7 a.m. local time, that's about 3.5 hours after the earthquake, I could communicate with my family. Landlines were working very, very quickly. And at least then I took a deep breath and knew that my family was safe. They told me that our house was severely damaged. We had some roof tiles and some walls coming down, but nothing serious, thank God.
Well, that's great, and that's great to hear, and we hope that it stays that way. Gideon Long, a BBC Chile correspondent, the Chilean government has a reputation, for good or ill, of making the trains run on time. I suspect that's a bit of an asset here in a situation like this. How have the military and police been deployed to preserve order in places like Concepcion and the coastal cities?
Well, the security situation is basically being monitored by the police, apart from in the city of Concepcion. That's a special case where the army have been drawn in. President Bachelet drew up an emergency decree yesterday giving the army control over the city of Concepcion. That's where we've seen some of the worst looting as people try and find food, water, anything they can from the city's supermarkets. But that's an exception. Everywhere else in the region, it's the police that are in control. We had a curfew overnight in the Bio region, and the government says that was largely observed, although of course many people are sleeping outside, refusing to go back to their homes because of fear of the aftershocks. But they said that the curfew was largely observed. It seems to have been a relatively peaceful night.
And we expect Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to be visiting later on this week. Gideon Long, is it fair to say in any sense that this, how the government deals with this, is a test of civilian leadership in Chile?
Absolutely, I think it is. And once again, we're seeing President Bachelet rise to the occasion. She's, as you know, leaving office in 2 weeks' time. She's going out on a high, already very popular, and she seems to be handling the situation very well. Yes, Hillary Clinton will be here later this week. We're not sure exactly what the extent of her visit will be. It may be that she doesn't get any further than Santiago Airport. But this is a visit that was already programmed, and it is going ahead.
All right, Gideon Long, BBC Chile correspondent, joining us from Santiago, Chile, and from Chien, 70 miles east of Concepcion. Daniel Vargara, good luck to you today, sir.
Thank you very much.
Daniel Vargara is an industrial engineer who found his family safe 70 miles from the epicenter. Time to check in on stories we're following at 15 minutes after the hour.
We're watching all the developments in Chile, of course, but in other news, Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she is confident of getting the votes needed to pass the president's health care reform bill. Speaking on ABC's This Week, Pelosi urged House Democrats to get behind the bill, even if it threatens their re-election chances.
We're not here just to perpetuate our service in Congress. We're here to do the job for the American people, to get them results that gives them not only health security, but economic security.
Overseas Marines in the Afghan city of Marja say the Taliban is no longer in control, but insurgents are now striking supply convoys with roadside bombs. NATO Lance Corporal John Kane says it's difficult to know which side the local people are on.
Going through all the houses, everyone acts the same, you know, they can't find anything. You know they're up to no good, some of them. And you just can't find anything.
Here in the U.S., nearly 200,000 homes and businesses are still without power this morning following winter storms in the Northeast. A slow-moving storm battered New Hampshire, New York, and Maine. Some people are still staying in shelters. The 2010 Olympics ended in a glittering finale yesterday, complete with music, dance, and fireworks after the Canadians' men's ice hockey team beat the USA in an exciting match to get the gold medal. The U.S. tallied 37 medals in all, the highest in any Winter Olympics. Speed skater Apollo Ono says he was impressed. Of course he would be impressed. And that's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, a talk with the U.S. ambassador to Chile for more on the relief efforts and the American responses in just a few minutes.
I'm Lynn Scherer in for Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. And we're talking this morning about Chile and the results of the earthquake there. Chilean President Michelle Bachelet has declared a state of catastrophe, and she has sent soldiers into some of the streets. Will that be enough? Will the country need U.S. help? Joining us now from the U.S. Embassy in Santiago, Chile, is Paul Simons, U.S. Ambassador to Chile. A career diplomat, he has served in that position for the past 2 years. Ambassador Simons, thank you so much for joining the Takeaway today.
Lynn, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you.
Give us your eye view of what's going on. What's the latest on the ground from Santiago? We know there have been aftershocks. Are you still feeling it?
Well, Lynn, this was obviously a major event. An 8.8 earthquake only occurs here once, certainly once every 20, 25 years. On the other hand, this is a very seismically active country. Chile is accustomed to major earthquakes. In 1960, there was a 9.4 earthquake, and in 1985, another 8.1. So the capacity to respond here is very impressive. And so things are moving ahead. I think what we're recognizing in the last 24 hours is the situation on the ground in the Santiago area, in the capital area, has improved substantially. Government is operating normally today. Stores are opened. Electricity is being restored. We fortunately have been able to identify all our embassy employees, 100 Americans, 200 Chileans. They're all safe.
That's all. That's all.
But really, the challenge is down south, in the Concepcion area, the epicenter, and in that region. The devastation was certainly much greater than what was initially expected. For that reason, President Bachelet, I think, did two things very interesting yesterday and important. The declaration of the state of emergency, which allowed the military and the police to go in and restore order. And secondly, she did open up for the first time to the possibility of international support.
And how much?
Really, this is an event that really is of massive proportions.
And Mr. Ambassador, how much? What should we know about the problems we heard where the police and the water cannons were brought in? Is that lawlessness being overblown, or was that in fact a serious problem?
Well, I think one thing you have to keep in mind is the whole Concepcion area has been without power, water, and telecommunications for about the past 48 hours. So, and also there's difficulty in terms of land transport. Under those kinds of situations, frequently you have outbreaks of lawlessness. So, for that reason, the state of emergency was declared.
Well, but Ambassador, just to elaborate,
beefing up security in those areas.
But just to make specific, you say land transport is a challenge. Is that because the bridges are out? Do the Chileans need help with airlifting? You know, what sort of lifelines are we talking about here?
Some of the bridges are out. That's correct. Some of the roads have faults in them, and they're having to make detours, make pontoons. So there's a major challenge in terms of sort of getting in and out of the Concepcion and Talca area. I don't think it's to the point now where they're air shipping in some supplies, but they're really looking to restore the land links. From a U.S. perspective, of course, our primary goal is to ensure the safety of the American citizens, particularly those in the Concepcion area, and that's where we've had a challenge because we haven't had much communication.
Because you can't get there.
And we may have as many as 1,000 Americans in the Concepcion area. We're not aware of any fatalities or serious injuries yet, but there are. But we have not been able to communicate with very many of our American citizens. We've reached out to them, but we have not had responses.
You are expecting Secretary of State Hillary Clinton later this week, a long-planned trip. Will the agenda get totally turned around? Will this all be about the earthquake, or are there other issues that you expect to deal with?
Well, certainly we're hoping that the Secretary will stop briefly by Chile during her swing through Latin America, and I would certainly expect that the response to the earthquake would be the number one item on the agenda at this point.
What does Chile want at this point, or could it use from the United States in terms of help?
Well, the Chileans do have a fair amount of their own capability. I think we need to remember they were among the first countries to supply search and rescue equipment and operatives to Haiti. So they have certain capabilities. They have a tremendous response of capability, but I think what they perhaps recognized yesterday was that the magnitude of this earthquake was such that they would be in a position to also entertain offers from abroad. So in her public address yesterday, the president outlined a series of areas where Chile would be open to working with its international partners, and we are taking a close look. The President Obama spoke with President Bachelet on Saturday, and we're now actively examining how we could most effectively respond to Chile's needs in a number of areas where we have expertise.
And just briefly, Mr. Ambassador, every tragedy comes down to an individual. We saw those Olympic athletes in Vancouver. Can the Chilean athletes get home? The airport's okay?
The airport is right now, the international airport is not open for regular commercial traffic, but they're bringing some planes in. They're working very quickly to restore fuel supply at the airport. And so I would think they'll definitely find a way to get their athletes back home.
Ambassador Paul Simons, U.S. Ambassador to Chile, thank you. Stay safe down there.
Coming up.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, the Chilean earthquake will certainly set the agenda in part for the U.S. government. We'll check the full agenda with Marcus Mabry and Rob Watson of the BBC in just a few minutes. Coming up, what's setting the agenda for this week? And certainly one of those things is our top story this morning at 30 minutes after the hour, the Chilean earthquake. The death toll in Saturday's massive 8.8 quake now stands at 708. The number is likely to climb in the coming days, but Chile Consul General Patricio Dam says strong building codes prevented total devastation in Chile's cities.
The regulations in Chile for buildings are very, very tough. Now they prove that the regulations are good and they have worked.
Earlier this hour, we spoke to Gideon Long, the BBC Chile correspondent in Santiago, who told us the ground is still shaking.
Several aftershocks overnight of a magnitude of around 5. So those shocks are still continuing, obviously causing a lot of concern for those people down in the south who've been devastated by this quake.
Geologists say there have been more than 100 aftershocks so far. In other news here at home, the White House is calling for a simple up or down vote on the health care reform bill. That means bypassing Republicans by a process called reconciliation. But Senator Lamar Alexander tells ABC News that would be a big mistake.
It would be a political kamikaze mission for the Democratic Party if they jam this through after the American people have been saying, look, we're trying to tell you in every way we know how, in elections, in surveys, in town hall meetings, we don't want this bill.
There are reports President Obama may endorse reconciliation in the next few days.
We're also learning more this morning about President Obama's nuclear weapons strategy. Our partner, The New York Times, is reporting the plan includes permanently reducing America's nuclear arsenal by thousands of weapons, as well as narrowing the circumstances under which the U.S. would use them. Let's check how that and other news is affecting the markets. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,325. The S&P opens at 1,104. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,238. And those are just some of the stories we're watching this morning. John?
Rescue and recovery efforts continue to hold Toyota's feet to the fire.
Got to change those job-killing policies.
Just to give you a sense of perspective.
So the agenda for this Monday morning, we're joined by Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
And Rob Watson joins us from London, BBC political correspondent in London. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning, all.
So, Marcus and Rob, first question, obviously, how is the earthquake, this devastation in Chile, going to set the agenda either for the international community or for the U.S. In the coming days, Marcus?
Well, for the U.S., it's interesting. You were just talking to the ambassador. It's the stark contrast between Chile and Haiti is remarkable. This is the worst natural catastrophe in Haitian history, in Chilean history, the president has said, the Chilean president has said, and yet you're talking about a death toll so far of less than 1,000 people. It's extraordinary, the difference. Haiti was not its worst ever natural disaster, but you're talking about a death toll there of 200,000. So it's a much narrower role for the U.S. here than there was in Haiti, for instance.
And indeed, as we saw in Haiti, the disaster highlights both the good and the bad about the U.S.-Chilean relationship. Right, Rob Watson?
Well, I guess to some extent, although I guess I'm agreeing with Marcus, really, that so far at least,
certainly from the perspective of London, and I presume from Washington, that there isn't quite the sense of running in to jump and fly in troops and aid. Although I suspect that what will happen in the long run, and I suspect it will be the same in Britain and the US, is that once the pictures start coming through, because we've been very short of pictures in London, once they do start coming through, that the charity will start flowing. Because it's extraordinary, you know, in my little town of Oxford, famous, of course, for its university at the school my kids go to, there is a Help for Haiti charity boxes in the school, and I took my kids to a birthday party recently where one of the parents said, don't buy a present, give some funds for Haiti.
So the connections are likely to emerge as the pictures emerge, and as we've been talking about, telecommunications is completely down near the epicenter, Concepcion. Marcus Mabry, in the news we were just reporting that the president is likely to endorse reconciliation on the health care reform bill this week. Lamar Alexander calls that a kamikaze mission for the Democratic Party. Is that a showdown?
Well, it's interesting. I don't know how many times Obama's been called a kamikaze. he's a little, kind of cold to be a kamikaze, you wouldn't think usually. But it is a showdown. Look, the Democrats have somewhat like a kamikaze, perhaps, nothing to lose at this point. Certainly have more to lose politically by not going forward with health care reform after spending so much political capital on it than they do by going forward with it, even through a reconciliation process. And that's what's controversial here. It's the process by which they're going to get it done. But I think the Democrats face a much greater damage by not getting it done at all.
And reconciliation, we should remind people, is a simple majority vote on budget matters. They'll attach the health care reform bill to the budget issue there and avoid the 60.
It's a sneaky backdoor way of doing it, and they've done it for other bills.
And they have.
Right.
And the Republicans have done it.
Yeah,
and the Republicans will call it a nuclear option, but it's been used before.
And so it is majority rules.
There's also a lot of posturing going on this, and who knows, if things will change as we get closer to the real vote.
Well, certainly some numbers are going to affect the agenda this week. Auto sales are going to be reported out for February. We're going to see Toyota's sales figures in light of everything we've been reporting for the last couple of weeks. What do you see?
Right. Well, obviously Toyota's going to take a real hit here. The question to watch is who benefits from Toyota's hit. Between the weather, the really bad weather we've had on much of the country, which is going to depress sales further, and the Toyota news, it's going to be interesting to see, do American automakers benefit here, or does it go more to really the kind of Koreans who've been making this amazing kind of surge forward in American
Isn't there also a question, Marcus, about the long-term effect of the Toyota? I mean, Toyota buyers are very loyal.
Sure, that's absolutely right. And Toyota, they didn't become the number one car company in the world for nothing. So this has really been a test of their reputation and their kind of wherewithal to withstand that.
But is there a response? I mean, if the figures go down, does it mean they're losing their loyal customers? Does it mean they all go to Korea? Does Ford inherit them?
The question is it short-term or long-term? We won't know that until we see it.
That we won't know. All right, so the day before the jobs report comes out, the House Foreign Affairs Committee plans on voting on a resolution that will recognize Armenian genocide by Ottoman Turks back in 1915. If this gets enough votes, it would then move to the House for a vote. Marcus, what's the political significance of this in the U.S.? And then I want to ask Rob what it means to the Turkish government.
It's a highly controversial topic. For many American politicians, when they're running for office, will say, the Armenian genocide, and they'll refer to it as a genocide. And yet, when they're in office, and President Obama, I think, is guilty of this, they'll call it, they won't use that word genocide, they'll use that word atrocity instead. This is very important to Armenian Americans, and it's important also to Turkey. Turkey is a very important country.
And it's important to the history of the 20th century. It was one of the first examples of widespread ethnic cleansing, something that we talk about much more routinely when you get to the Yugoslavian period of time. Rob Watson, what do you think the significance is of this vote, and how closely are people in Europe and Turkey watching this?
Well, I should think they're watching it incredibly closely in Turkey. And all I would say just briefly on this subject is, I remember from when I was in Washington and at the UN, the amount of effort countries like Turkey put into lobbying in Washington and elsewhere to prevent this kind of thing happening shows you just how much they care about it. I mean, the Turkey on the Armenian issue is one. I could think of lots of others. So I guess my comeback is, if you think about how much effort they put in trying to stop these things, you can guess how much they're not going to like it.
And nearly a century removed from the actual events.
I just want to say that I was actually in Armenia and went to visit the genocide site, and the people there are so grateful when you do that, because they feel that it's getting the word out.
And it is real. It's a place you can go and visit, as opposed to some
rumor and innuendo.
Next Sunday, Iraq's going to hold its national elections, long delayed. But is this mission accomplished, Rob Watson?
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see, won't we? I mean, it's extraordinary, certainly the way in Britain. It's difficult for me to gauge in the United States, but given how much blood and treasure and diplomacy and might and money has been spent there, how little attention is focused on the Iraqi elections. But look, it seems as though one hurdle has been just about kind of cleared, and that is an attempt previously to get an awful lot of Sunni political candidates banned, a court overturned that, so hopefully they will be standing, although there's a chance they'll be challenged afterwards. But I think the thing to really look out for is, you know, will we see a breakaway from the sort of sectarian nature of the politics that has dominated the post-invasion period? And
will there be relief? Will there be actually relief in this conflict?
I think there would be relief.
We'll just have to see. Or will it be like The Hurt Locker, the movie favored to win the Oscars? Marcus Mabry, thanks so much. And Rob Watson, BBC correspondent in London.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Lynn Scherr in for Celeste Headlee, here with John Hockenberry. And we have some international business news for you. AIG, the insurance giant, will sell the Asian arm of its life insurance business to British insurance giant Prudential PLC, not to be confused with the American company Prudential Financial. And that deal is worth $35 billion. This is AIG's largest sale since being bailed out by the U.S. government in 2008. And it will be the biggest repayment AIG will be able to make to the U.S. so far. BBC business correspondent Duncan Bartlett joins us from London. Good morning, Duncan.
Good morning.
Thank you for helping us understand this. Why do we care about this? What's it do for us?
Well, from an American taxpayer's point of view, this is a very significant deal because, as you mentioned, AIG had to be rescued by the American government at the height of the financial crisis because it had run into enormous financial difficulties. And a vast amount of money was spent by the American government and thus by the American taxpayer to keep it in business. It is now 80% owned by the American government. But obviously it had built up operations in all parts of the world, in Europe and in Asia as well, and it's now selling these Asian assets. As you mentioned, the price there that it's agreed with Prudential, a British company which is listed on the London Stock Exchange, is $35.5 billion. And that money will be going back to the American government and to the American taxpayer.
So how much have you been able to break it down? What does it really mean for the taxpayer, this $35 billion?
Well, we know that as part of the government's rescue program, it put in a very, very large sum of money to AIG, much larger than $35 billion. So this won't be able to pay off all its debts, but it'll go some of the way to doing so. And of course, it's significant for Prudential because this will double the size of that company straight away, and it will give it not just a foothold in the Asian market, which it already has, but it will make it the leading insurance company across Asia. So in a sense, you'll see a power shift from the American company holding all these insurance policies across Asia to a British one doing so.
And does that also shift some of the problems to the Brits?
Well, the interesting thing is that the Asian arm of AIG was actually doing rather well. That wasn't in problems, which is why it's been attractive to Prudential. And obviously, that's one of the reasons why it's paying so much money for it. So it's not as though Prudential is taking over a problematic company. Far from it. And in fact, what it expects to be able to do is to see a lot more customers, particularly in China, where many people are taking out insurance for the first time. Now, there has been traditionally a cultural resistance in China to people taking out, for example, life assurance. People felt it was rather morbid and perhaps unlucky to do so.
It is morbid when you come right down to
it. Yes, it is. but nevertheless, many people in China have now realised the importance of insurance, and they've been going to companies to try and find insurance, of course, not just for life insurance, but also for properties and other possessions that they own, cars and so on. And so that's a very, very significant and growing market.
Duncan, does this, in fact, vindicate the bailout, the fact that it's now bought and some of the money is coming back to the U.S.?
I think it's not the end of all the problems for AIG by any means, but at least this is showing willing to the U.S. government that it is prepared to take some urgent action in order to be able to pay back some of the money that it owes.
BBC business correspondent Duncan Bartlett joining us from London. Thanks for your insight into that new AIG business news. I'm Lynn Scherr, sitting in for Celeste Headlee. Happy to be joining John Hockenberry. Coming up, we talk about family life just as we do every Monday. What happens when kids return to the nest? One-third of adult American children live with their parents. We'll find out why in a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. More than 700 people are now thought to have been killed in Saturday's massive earthquake in Chile. Officials say 500,000 homes were destroyed in the 8.8 magnitude quake. Aftershocks have been reported during the night and a curfew has been imposed in the city of Concepcion. In the past hour, we spoke to the U.S. Embassy and ambassador in Chile, Paul Simons. He praised the quick reaction of the Chilean leader, Michelle Bachelet.
Declaration of the state of emergency, which allowed the military and the police to go in and restore order. And secondly, she did open up to the possibility of international support.
And that international support will come in the midst of international economic aftershocks from the earthquake on Saturday. To tell us more about the economic impacts, we're joined by New York Times Wall Street and finance reporter Louise Story. Good morning, Louise.
Morning.
So what are we expecting? I mean, this is one of the strongest economies in South America.
It is. So the damages are estimated to be $15 billion to $30 billion. And just to put that into perspective, John, Hurricane Katrina cost $40 billion in terms of insured losses here in the U.S. So it's close to Hurricane Katrina. The good news is that Chile's central bank has a very good reputation. What they've been doing since 2007 is Chile has been putting aside the extra money they make in copper in an offshore wealth fund that's gotten up to be $11 billion now. And by doing that, they've become a net creditor, not a net borrower. So if they need to go borrow some money now to clean this up, they're in pretty good shape.
Now, you mentioned copper there. Certainly, the repercussions for commodity prices are going to be one of the immediate impacts, right?
That's right. So a third of all copper in the world comes from Chile. The world's biggest copper company, Codelco, is based there. They closed down several mines this weekend. They've already opened some of them, but it did send copper prices up this morning on the London Metal Exchange. And we, you know, a lot of people think it'll send some more disruptions into the commodities exchanges till we see everything open up.
And copper in the last few months has been a real indicator of demand, industrial demand, and that's been depressed. So even if it does spike, do you think it's a long-term thing?
Right. Well, there is actually copper reserves. There is a big copper inventory. It's the highest it's been in 6 years of copper sitting around not being used. So there is some room for this disruption. It's just a question of how long it goes on for.
All right. Louise Story from our partner, the New York Times, taking a look at the economic aftershocks from the Chilean earthquake. Marines in the Afghan city of Marja say the Taliban is no longer in control there, but they say Taliban insurgents in Afghanistan are now striking supply convoys with roadside bombs. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Pull out of the shadows and find adventure. There we are and what we are is still family.
Well, if the President of the United States does it, it has to be okay, right? We're talking about living with your parents or in-laws, and for this week's family segment, we're talking about this growing trend. But we are not just talking about, as Mr. Obama does, having the first mother-in-law there. According to a study by the AARP, one-third of all 18 to 49-year-olds also live at, well, home, that is, their parents' home, otherwise known as their back. Here to share statistics on who's doing it and tips on how to make the most of this situation is Yolanda Gold-Cavaness, a longtime family and parenting journalist whose work regularly appears in Redbook and iVillage. Kristen L'Esperance of Burlington, Vermont, also joins us. She is a 30-year-old interior architect who was forced to move back in with her parents last year due to underemployment. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yolanda, let me start with you. 33%, big number. Is that bigger than ever with these 19 to 49-year-olds moving back in?
Well, you know, it's kind of back to the future. It's not bigger than ever. When you think about it, generations ago, this was quite common to have several generations under one roof. We've gotten away from that, of course, so it's the biggest it's been in a very long time. And I think, as Kristen would probably attest, the economy is largely to blame.
Economy is almost totally to blame. Kristen, let's go right to you. You are living with your parents.
I am.
How do you feel? How do you feel about it?
It's rough. You know, obviously, one of the most discernible benefits of it is, you know, I'm just finished graduate school and, you know, no job, no money. So, as my father said, at least you're not living under a bridge somewhere. But other than that, it's been a struggle, I think, for both of us.
What's tell me, first of all, some of the benefits they've got other than the fact that you're not paying rent. Is it okay to be with your folks for a little while now? Never mind. I withdraw that question. Okay, let's move on. Let's move on to the biggest problems. I mean, are you feeling like a teenager? Do you have a curfew and stuff like that?
Well, I don't have a curfew, but you know, some of the sort of conventions of high school are sort of happening a little bit in terms of, if I'm not going to be home, I need to call and, you know, let them know. And it's more of an adult negotiation now, but the reality is I'm sharing a car with my mother, and we're all sharing a bathroom. And I've been living, you know, in New York for the last 4 years, and so pretty distant physically.
Yeah,
so that's, now we're all together.
That's tough. Yolanda, Kristen is an example of one of the things that's going on. But not to make really to make too light of all this, are there some benefits to having someone of the younger generation moving back in with the folks?
Oh, there are huge benefits. I mean, as Kristen explains, we can all see the drawbacks. I mean, especially if you're going back to your childhood bedroom, you know, you can't help but kind of revert back to that child-parent dynamic. But the benefits are huge of having multi-generations under one household. I mean, we learn from one another. Parents at that age really do want in, even if it's difficult sometimes to give in to that and to live with that. They want to be a part of your lives. And if you have children, and that's part of the mix, I know Kristen doesn't, it's a wonderful built-in babysitting network. The children love to spend time with their grandparents, and it's beneficial to them as they learn about their past and history in general.
And Yolanda, I mean, for much of American history, the extended family was the support network
for all kinds of people. We've moved far away from that. So, I mean, I have to say, as much as I know it must be uncomfortable for you, Kristen, I have three kids, and I'm thinking, Mama, please come home.
Yeah, but what about, okay, I like the grandparenting and the babysitting idea, but I'm now putting myself in the mind of the parents and saying, hold it, we just got this empty nest, and I want a little space myself. I'm the older generation.
You know what's really important here? You've got to have the talk. And that means that early on, and it's never too late, it's great to do it before the whole thing gets in motion, but you just need to sit down and talk about boundaries. You need to sit down and talk about the financial arrangement. If there's no money contribute, what will you be contributing instead of money? Maybe there's some certain chores you'll be taking over on a regular basis. You really want to set it up so that you have a roommate situation, because, I mean, if you have a roommate, you know that there's certain common areas. You know that there's certain times that person uses the kitchen, and there's certain times.
Well, we got to find out, though. Kristen, have you had the talk?
We have had the talk, and it's a lovely idea, having a roommate. But the reality is my parents, you know, they're approaching retirement, and are we all going to move to Florida? You know, it wasn't in the plan. So I think it's a challenge. And of course they want to be able, and they're glad that they're able to do it for me. But, you know, none of us a year ago thought that this is what the future was going to hold. And hopefully it isn't.
It isn't. Kristen, just curious, do you contribute at all to the food? I know you're not paying rent, but what is your role in expenses there?
It's non-existent at this point.
Okay, well, so you're waiting to get reemployed, which we all hope everybody will do.
Well, you're an interior architect. You could at least, like, work on the furniture in the living room, right?
John's home needs a redo. They're probably stuck in the 70s.
Yeah, John's anticipating what's going to happen when his brood moves back in with him. So
he
wants your tips, Yolanda. So all of you, thank you. Yolanda Gault-Cavanis, longtime family and parenting journalist, thanks so much for joining us. And Kristen L'Espérance of Burlington, Vermont, to you and to your parents, I say good on you and good luck. Keep it up.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you.
If any of you out there have a not-so-empty nest story, we'd love to hear it. If you move back with your parents, is it working? Is it not working? What are the rules? Have you had the talk? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org.
Our minds are with the people of Chile, and it might have you thinking how to prepare when tragedy strikes. We want to check how these recent natural disasters have put things in perspective for you. You know how to reach us. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Lynn Scher for Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.